Accession number 27756, Real One.
Bill Fenwick-Smith, Real One. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born at Whitley Bay, near Newcastle-on-Tyne.
And when was that?
That was 1922, April 1922.
And what did your parents do?
My father was a rope maker.
What did that entail? It's an interesting trade. What did that entail?
No, well, he didn't know. He was the managing director of a firm of rope makers.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had a brother and two sisters.
What about your education? Where were you educated?
I was educated at Bootham School, York.
And any favourite subjects or activities while you were at school?
The mathematics was always my favourite subject, although I never used it in later life.
Any sporting activities? Sporting activities?
Oh, yes. I used to do old sports. Fives, tennis, cricket. Swimming was my main one. I used to swim 3 or 4 times a day.
And when you were that age, did you have any interest in the Navy or aviation matters while you were growing up?
I fancied going to sea occasionally, yes, I did.
At Whitley Bay, was there lots of...
Well, we left Whitley Bay and went to a suburb of Newcastle called Benton when I was about 2. So, but we weren't far from Whitley Bay, and we used to we had a swimming club that used to swim at Christmas, just in and out very rapidly. It was a good place for doing that, Whitley Bay.
And what were conditions like as you were growing up in the area? Was there an economic depression at that period?
Well, I didn't notice it. There obviously was during the 20s, the late 20s. But I went to school from 4 or 5 or whatever it was. I used to walk a mile, I think. Nobody ever took us to school in those days. We went on our own.
And as you were growing up there, was there anything else that you were involved in, any other activities that interested you other than the swimming? And
no, tennis. I was very keen on tennis. Very keen on playing tennis. So I tried to golf occasionally, but I wasn't much good. My brother was an expert at it, so I left him to it.
And as you went into the 1930s, were you away at school at that stage?
Yes, I was away the whole time.
Were you aware of the sort of situation in Europe at that time, in the 1930s?
We used to have lectures at school about it. It's a Quaker school, and they were always interested in what was going on. They tried to keep us interested, but you know what boys are like.
Did you feel that there may have been a coming war at that stage? Did you?
Never thought about it. Never thought about it. In those days, I always wanted to be a farmer. And I don't know, I used to go and stay with an aunt sometimes during the holidays out in Northumberland. And I always wanted to be a farmer.
So there was no real sort of anticipation of what might be coming at that stage?
No, you were... nothing at all.
Do you have any memories of things like the Munich crisis at all? The Munich crisis in 1938?
No. No. The first memory I can really think about it is Chamberlain's declaration. And then the air raid sirens going.
What were you doing and where were you when that... Were you listening to the radio?
I happened to be at home. It was a weekend, if I remember rightly. I happened to be at home.
And What did your parents think about the possibility?
Father was away playing golf, I remember. And mother wasn't there either. She was visiting a relation or something. There were only the children there, but that, when I say children, my eldest sister's older than me. Both sisters are older. So we were hardly children.
And at that stage, did you think that you might become involved?
Didn't honestly think about it, because I was a farm student. And I thought, well, I don't know. My best friend there, he got involved very quickly because he'd been in the Merchant Navy. Oh, he was in the Merchant Navy, and he went into the R&R straight away. But I did think that if I was going to go, I'd want to go into the Navy.
So did you continue your studies as the war started?
Did I
continue your studies as the war started?
Yes, I stayed on farming.
What type of things were you doing? Was there any changes in what you were doing at that stage?
It was a big estate. A couple of milk herds they had, and lots of other things. It was just a general training. They had three students on the farm. The others stayed. I did think of staying, but I always wanted to do something else sometimes. I wanted to join the Navy.
Were there any kind of changes to farming at all that took place after the declaration of war, to sort of regiment it or organise it in any manner?
I never missed anybody. We still used to have about seven or eight people in a hayfield, as against the one you have today. Life was very different, very different.
Was there a need to produce more, though, once the war had started?
Was there
a need to produce more?
Well, they tried. I remember we sowed one field of wheat, 7 acres of wheat. I think we sowed 10 bags of seed there and only got 7 bags off it. It was pretty hopeless, I thought. But no, I think there was a slight... Of course, all the ploughing was done by horses, of course. It was much slower. Life was much slower.
And with the war starting, was there introduction of people like land girls to work on the farm?
I never saw land girls. That really got away before they came along very much. Well, there was one girl we had, but she wasn't a land girl. She was a student, really. But right from 1939 onwards, I thought of joining the Navy.
So how did you go about that process?
I went to the recruiting office. There was a large, I'll never forget him, a large Sergeant Major of Marines there. And he said, "What do you want, Sonny?" I said, "I've come to join the Navy." Oh, he said, "We only want cooks and greasers. There was a war on," and this is what he said. I said, "Oh, I don't want to be a cook or a greaser, thanks very much. I thought I wanted to drive the ship or something." "No," he said, "I've got just the job for you. You want to join the Fleet Air Arm?" So I said, no, if I wanted to fly, I'd go and join the RAF. "No, this is just the thing. Here's the form. Take it home. Get your mum to sign it and come back tomorrow," which I did.
What did your family think about the potential of you going into the Fleet Air Arm?
I don't know. They didn't discuss it.
When was that? What year was that?
That was beginning of 40.
So once you'd filled out the form, what was the next stage?
When I left the farm.
When you filled out the form to join the Fleet Air Arm,
yes.
What was the next stage?
I waited about 4 months, I think. And then was called down to Portsmouth for interviews and what have you. And we all went up in turn and got a coloured piece of paper, if I remember, if you were going to be a pilot or being thrown out. and I was accepted as a pilot. And I was told to go home and wait, and wish I had another 4 or 5 months. I stayed farming all this time. I joined the LDV and the Home Guard or whatever it was at that time.
Can you remember on the when you went to your selection panel, what type of questions they were asking you?
Well, why you wanted to join the Navy? They were asking why you wanted to fly. I had great difficulty. I didn't really want to fly. However, and what you'd done with your life and everything. Because I had done a bit of sea just after I left school. I left school in December 1938. Father got me a place on a cargo boat which went out to Vancouver. And it wasn't really a working job, but I was allowed to do what I could on it. So I had, 4 months going out there and coming back again.
What types of jobs had you done while you were on the ship?
I went into the boiler and helped to clean that out. And helped to clean the hold on the way out. It was empty. They were going for a load of timber. And we got back to Immingham sometime in April.
Did you enjoy the experience?
Oh yes, Sarah enjoyed it, going through the Suez Canal, and that was a great experience, that was.
Can you tell me something about your time with the Home Guard, or Local Defence Volunteers?
Well, funnily enough, during these months that I was waiting, we did a raid on an anti-aircraft station, just to show. And we went in a hay cart, and I was under the hay. And some very kind soldier put his bayonet into it. And that was my first life. It went through my leg and not through anything else.
How had the Home Guard been organised? How were you organised?
Oh, it was all organised by the one estate, you see. The owner, he was the captain. And I don't know who was the sergeant, but all the members of the staff on the estate were the members of the Home Guard. All local for that.
And did any of them have First World War experience?
No, none of them.
Were there a lot of them like yourself who were really waiting to go into the services?
No, because they were occupied position, you see, farming, and I can't think of any of them were thinking of going into the services. Perhaps some of them probably would later, because there were some younger ones, some of the sons of the people.
And given the shortages, did you have equipment and uniforms at all?
We didn't have any guns, I remember. We got a bit of... We got hats or something. I can't remember. But it was very, very little.
Did you receive armbands?
Yes, armbands.
And
we had a hut on a very high point, which we used to man at night.
You said you didn't have any weapons. Arms? But what did you have any weapons at all? Was it stuff that had been manufactured?
I think just before I left, we got the old 303 rifles. But up till then, I don't think we had anything at all. We just had a stick or something, or a walking stick.
People have often seen Dad's Army on television.
Yeah.
Would you say that that's a fair portrayal of what the Home Guard was like?
Pretty well, I think. At times it was, I think, yes.
You mentioned the raid where you had a bayonet jabbed into your leg. What was the plan for that?
We were trying to show that you could get into the place without being discovered. It didn't work, of course, but I was whipped away in ambulance to Newcastle and to hospital.
Did it heal fairly quickly, your leg?
Yes, luckily it did. And although when I finally went, was called up, I did mention it, they didn't bother the head about it.
How did that occur? How were you called up? What was the process there?
I just had a note saying report to HMS Daedalus, Leon Soland.
And how were you received when you arrived at Daedalus?
Oh, well received, yes. Yes. I can't honestly remember much about it. We were there for a week or 2 weeks, something like that, then moved, of course, to Gosport, to Wilmot's place. I was course 32, I think it was, 32.
When was that? When had you been called up down there?
Oh, dear. We've reached about the end of 41, I think. Oh. It must have been 41 sometime. I know I was at Gosport at Christmas, and that would be Christmas 41.
So we're looking at autumn,
yes.
Winter 41 that you went down there. While you're at Daedalus, what was the type of training that you were inducted into there?
In Daedalus, we only got uniformed. We didn't do any training. The training was done at Gosport, at HMS St Vincent.
Did you do any kind of drill at that stage?
Oh, yes, drill at Vincent. We were drilled. And we did Morse code and all. I think we were there for a month, so a bit more than a month.
Was that really a sort of basic naval training as much as fleet
yes,
air arm
was.
At that stage?
It was, yes. You were shown how to salute properly and all that sort of business, and told how to acknowledge appointments and how to... No, it was completely naval training. Completely naval training. Nothing to do with flying.
And what rank did you have as you'd gone in there?
What?
What rank did you have at that stage?
Naval Airman Second Class.
You mentioned, obviously, when you went over to Vincent, Chief Petty Officer Wilmot.
Yeah.
What was he like?
He was all right. I didn't have any trouble with him. He used to shout a lot. But he was very good, I think, very good. I think, really, he was very popular. Some people objected to being... Well, they weren't used to being told what to do, I suppose. I know.
Because he had, I believe, some long-term service with the Navy, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
For a long time.
Yes, he had. Oh, yes. He was very well known to every Fleet Air Arm person that went through there.
Was he a character? Did he have certain idiosyncratic...
Oh, yes, he was a character, definitely.
Can you remember any incidents that...
No, I can't. Can't, really. I can't.
At this stage, you were doing drill, and did you do any arms training during your training at all there?
I can't remember. We had to take a drill. Each person had to take it at one time or another. And you had to learn about the flags and everything else. But
did you do any seamanship at all?
No, not really. No, I don't think so. Unless you call the Morse code and that sort of thing seamanship.
How were you instructed in the Morse code?
Oh, we had lessons. It was just like going to school. It was very much like going to school. You had an earphone, and someone tapped something out, and you were supposed to get it, and I used to have to look at the chap next door. I wasn't very good at it, I must admit.
Did you have to reach a certain standard, though, to continue?
I suppose you did, yes. You did have to pass a standard. Whether everybody passed, I think most people did. Most people passed. And were then, of course, divided up to their flying schools.
Did you have a choice in where you went to your flying school, or were you just allocated?
Now, that I honestly can't remember. I can't remember that. I mean, I went to Elmden, but I can't remember. There were a very mixed lot of people. There were a lot of New Zealanders amongst them. And quite a lot of them went to Elmden too. I remember I took two of them home when we had some leave. No, I can't remember about that.
So you went to Elmden. Was that the start of elementary flying training?
It was indeed, yes, under the RAF.
What was the station like?
Well, we were billeted near Coventry, in a black and white place that I suppose had been a hotel, I don't know, or a boarding house or something. And it was about 2 or 3 miles from the airfield anyway. We used to go. I don't know if we went in a coach or a truck. I can't honestly remember. We were taken to the airfield and each allocated with one RAF instructor.
Were you allocated the same instructor for the whole course?
Yes.
Who was your instructor, can you?
I've got a picture of him somewhere, but I can't remember what he was called. He was very good because I was having a bit of trouble to get off, because the thing was, of course, to get solo, and then there you go. And he made me take my shoes off and use just stocking feet. Oh, mind the tiger moth, you need that anyway. Once I'd got away, it was perfect, but it took me about an hour longer than most of the others somehow. I think it took me about 9.5, 10 hours.
Was he an RAF pilot, your instructor?
Oh, yes, RAF pilot.
Was he a sergeant or an officer?
Hmm?
Was he a sergeant or an officer?
No, he was a sergeant. The chap that I had was a sergeant. But, of course, the tests at the end of each period was done by an officer.
What was the kind of sequence of instruction? I'm thinking, were you given a familiarisation of the tiger moth to start it? What did that entail them doing?
Well, he took you up and flung you around a bit. See that you weren't sick, I suppose, I don't know. And explained about, if you pushed that this way and that way and that way. He was very good. I appreciate that fellow. He was very good indeed.
Was that the first time you'd actually flown, or had you flown
yes,
before?
Oh, yes, and been near an aeroplane before.
What was the sensation like on that first flight? How did you feel about getting airborne?
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
Was that the same case, would you say, with everybody who was on your course?
No, because some of them didn't even get through the first to solo. There were three or four of them didn't even get solo. But most of them, especially the New Zealanders, were very keen to fly.
So once you'd familiarised yourself with the aircraft and you'd had that first flight, what was the next stage of the process? Did you have to learn how to taxi the aircraft, or Did you have to learn all the cockpit instruments, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I had to do that. There weren't many instruments in a Tiger Moth, of course, only the one indicator, I think. Yes, that's we got circuits and bumps till we could do it. And then he gets out the back and says, off you go, and you're on your own. You bounce like anything. It's a wonder they didn't break more aircraft.
What was the Tiger Moth like as an aircraft?
Well, I thought it was fantastic to start with, but of course there wasn't much power in it really, but it was an ideal aircraft for doing loops and rolls and things like that. It was very good. Yeah, although I bounced, I must admit, bounced like mad. But in later life, I came to land something else there, I forget. And I thought, what an enormous place this is. Why did it take me so long to land that Tiger Moth?
You mentioned that you'd had a little bit of a problem and your instructor made you take your shoes
off. I was too ham-fisted on the controls.
Did it need a delicate touch, the Tiger Moth?
Or? Slightly more delicate than I had, anyway. I was too ham-fisted with my feet.
And what would that be? Would that be the rudder control? Or?
That's right, the rudder control.
So would it just need a gentle touch much of the time?
Yes, it did want just a gentle touch. Did need just gentle touch.
What was the pattern of instruction prior to going solo? What were the types of things? You said circuits and bumps, but what other things were you doing in the aircraft prior to going solo?
Very little else. Just take off, you went like this, and you came down again. Then you'd taken off, and you went square round, and you always were shown to come in the same direction every time. Always come from the same direction.
So he would teach you how to do, what, gentle turns and
that's
that
right.
Sort of thing?
To start with.
What about taxiing the Tiger Moth? Was that needed a special technique?
Never found that difficult. Don't know.
Because
there were no brakes on it. But that didn't seem to matter. When you pulled back the throttle, they stopped. The thing stopped.
Did you have to zigzag it to for visibility or to slow it down?
No, I don't know. I was fairly tall, of course. I seemed able to see all right. No trouble.
Can you tell me about that first solo, the processes of what happened when you did your first solo in the Tiger Moth?
Not really, I can't remember it. I bumped like mad, but finally got down, and that's all I can remember about it, to be perfectly honest.
What was your feelings, though? Were you happy to have made that first solo?
Yes, very happy to have made the first solo. Yes, very much so.
What was the next stage after you'd soloed? Were you involved in other types of training? I'm thinking along the lines of cross countries and navigation and that sort of thing.
Yes, but not till the first thing was he took you up and showed you how to do rolls and how to get out of a spin, which was important, of course, very important. That was the main things. And then we did cross countries. After that, our cross country was to Cambridge. And my brother was at Cambridge at the time, and I spent the night there with him, very badly, really. Had far too much beer, and then flew back the next day.
How did you navigate cross country? What was the procedure for navigating cross country at that stage?
Well, we just took an estimate, basically. I can't even remember if we had a map. I suppose we must have had a map. Yes, we must have had a map. But I don't honestly remember how it happened.